I was living like a double life. I had one foot in one camp and one in the other. Got a job with the Smithsonian, and I became a staff scientist, a biologist. I knew what they were thinking, but they had no idea what I was thinking. I was led by the Lord in all of this. My attitude was, what are we doing today, Father? All the stacks of journals and all the periodicals, I said, how can creationists even keep up with these people? Within about a half hour, it came to me. He says, we don't have to. They've done all the work. We can interpret all that work, but with a worldview that's completely different than theirs. I had looked at ICR 15 years before that. I had someone tell me, someday you could be working for these guys. So meeting Dr. Galuza was kind of the catalyst. Then the one time he writes me one, he says, wondering if you'd ever considered coming out of that world and joining us. It was perhaps the most important email in my life. I've seen both sides. They have never seen the other side. Truth is, once you put both of them together, you get an even deeper truth.
So Dr. Boyle, let's just start here. Would you say that you were always naturally curious?
Yeah, I think I was. As a little boy, I was curious about everything, especially the outdoors. So we lived in the suburbs of the Bay Area, large family. We had probably 2 to 3 acres. We were right up against the woods. We had a creek going all around our property. So we had raccoons and possums and deer and birds and salamanders and frogs, everything there. And then there was probably 200 acres of hillside up behind us in woods. So, you know, I did the regular things that most kids do. I played all the sports, but I was always looking at trees and climbing up in trees and looking at the birds and all the animals. So I was curious about everything there was.
Yeah, ample opportunity to spend some time in the outdoors.
Absolutely.
I mean, when you say large family, what do you mean by large?
I'm one of 8 children.
One of 8 children. Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. So obviously you were a little boy and you spent a lot of time outdoors looking at animals and experiencing nature. How would you describe your interest in science at the time? What were you interested in science or was it more of just like that natural, like, oh, this is cool and interesting, and so I'm going to look at it?
That was a little bit of both.
Okay.
So having older brothers and sisters, they were also bringing me interesting things from the world. You know, just one of my brothers raised pigeons, and he had property up north. And my dad and I used to watch Jacques Cousteau's, you know, the undersea world.
Yes.
And Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom and National Geographic, and we studied all that stuff. But every time I got a chance to go outside, I was outside and I was just looking at everything. I would climb up a tree and stay there for a couple hours. And animals would come underneath me. Birds would come up next to me. It was just like a unique experience. I thought about science, but not the application of science. I didn't go to the library and look up how they did science. But I was definitely immersed in it. In fact, by the time I was 12 years old, I knew the names, the flight patterns, the calls of 50 to 60 different birds.
Wow.
And walked around with my Peterson Field Guide series, and I was looking at everything I could. And then on vacations, I would wander off, go down to the river, go out fishing, do something, always looking at the water, the air, the plants and animals.
Right. And your parents were like, Dr. Boyle? Well, they wouldn't call you Dr. Boyle. That would be weird, but.
That's true.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, how would you describe your journey into science proper then? If you were just kind of tangentially involved in science, you weren't into, we'll say, the academia side of things, how would you describe that journey?
Well, that journey was definitely not a direct journey. I had a lot of opportunities to travel around, at least with the Bay Area, and as a young man, young boy actually, I traveled up north into California where one of our brothers had land. So I went to the ocean along the coast of California. I went up to the rivers and did fishing. We had property way up in the north of Humboldt State area. And we're talking about major forests and bears and lions and all that stuff. And so that was, I spent every summer I could up there. I really didn't think that I was a scientist of any kind. And I thought maybe this would be the natural tendency for me because I was already interested in these things. Played all the sports, basketball, baseball, track, played about 10 years of soccer. So that was interesting and appropriate right now with FIFA going on.
That's
so
right.
It's kind of exciting.
World Cup happening right here in our backyard. Yes.
Right. So, let's just say I had my mandatory childhood for the first 18 years. And when I went to high school, it was probably the first time I really looked at science as a discipline or something that was formal. Mm. I went to Catholic school. In fact, I was raised in an Irish Catholic family, 7 years in Catholic school, then a year in public school, then public high school. I found nature study, and then I found biology and chemistry, and that was it. I was hit. This stuff is amazing. It has answers. It's extraordinary. It makes sense of all the things that I was looking at from a bigger perspective, but not looking at the details.
Right.
So I continued down that route. And then after high school, I had a chance to go to college, but I didn't go. So life picked up there. We're talking about the early 70s at this point. So I'm a child of the 60s. We didn't have a lot of money in our family. There was no incentive to go to college, no opportunity to go to college. So I began to work. And I did all kinds of jobs, restaurant work, worked in a winery, worked on the golf course at Sonoma National. That used to be the land our family had 5 generations ago. Then I just let time go by, and I've got into construction a lot. In fact, I spent 10 years as a foreman putting up steel-engineered buildings or pre-engineered buildings in California, Arizona, and a little bit in Texas. Mm. So that took most of my time, and I didn't even think about science. I mean, I'd be looking at birds and looking at snakes and things like this, but never thinking, I'm going to go be a scientist.
Not what I expected coming from you,
right.
From what I know of
right,
you.
Right, right.
Obviously, something changed because you are now a scientist. Can you walk me through kind of the direction shift that happened there?
Yeah, so I'm about 27, 28 years old. This is when a major transformation took place in my life. I had been working for a long time, trying everything, but never really getting anywhere.
Right.
Always knew that I had a better mental capacity. I had greater interests. Mm-hmm. Most of my high school buddies, they thought I should be the one to go to college. In fact, they actually came down with a signed application to Humboldt State University when I was 20. Said, you're the one who should be up here going to school. And I was, you know, caught up in life and different
right.
things like that. But then I met a friend, and they introduced me to the Bible. And this is odd because I was raised in a Catholic family, Irish Catholic family, right? We never were exposed to a Bible.
Right.
My father never opened up a Bible in our house. The nuns never had Bibles. There weren't Bibles in the pews. There weren't Bibles in our desk. I had no connection between Genesis and the creation and the Creator and what I was actually normally, or shall I say, innately interested in would be biology.
Right.
So now I'm well into my second childhood. This is a voluntary childhood now. I'm no longer on the path, living out in the world.
Right.
So I meet this friend, and they introduce me to the Bible, and they tell me about the gospel, and they say, you've got one of the most important decisions in your life in front of you, and you probably don't even know that. So we talked for a while, and I thought about that decision. I said, let me get back to you. And I went away for a couple weeks. And then I came back, and I said, tell me more. And that person and her brother-in-law, who was a pastor, sat down and told me what the gospel really means and the gift of Christ. And I said, I would like to make that decision. And has been the most important decision in my life. In fact, it's the most important decision of anybody's life. It comes to that place. And at that moment, I was born again, and I had a Bible in my hands and went back home, and I started reading, and I didn't stop. I read cover to cover in about 6 months. And from the very first verse, it made sense. It was true.
Mm-hmm.
The commentary was accurate. The science that I thought was interesting was actually being told in the Bible, and yet this was thousands of years before any of the science we have today.
Right.
So this was a big change in my life in a new direction. And I thought, okay, maybe I should go do and follow what I'm naturally designed to do, or you know. And that wasn't immediate, though. I still had some work to do.
Right. Well, how old were you at this point?
I'm 28.
28, okay. And you mentioned, you know, you didn't have any Bibles being raised, even being raised Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
Was there any concept at all of a creator God at that point? Or was it just very distant?
No, it was more of a religious experience.
Okay.
I mean, we go to church. They've got the costumes on. They've got all the icons there. Some of the Catholic kids are some of the wildest bunch you've ever met in your life. You know, whatever we do, we can go to confession. And so it was religious, right? Mm-hmm. It was formal. And none of my siblings had picked up either, because we each got to a position in life at about 13 or 14 where we had a choice whether we needed to go to church anymore. Mm-hmm. Mandatory Easter and Christmas, but we didn't have to go to church. And I think the whole family thought, one by one, if this is God, if this is the truth, I don't want any part of that. And so we had the alternate effect of being in a religious affiliation, but not getting any closer to the truth, not understanding the gospel, not hearing the gospel.
Right.
And of course, that wasn't transmitted to my father. My mother was the one who prayed with us.
Yeah.
But she was still, she was reading the Catholic Bible and not really in tune, because at that time, especially in those days, the priest was the one who was going to tell you what's in the Bible.
Right.
We weren't raised in a Christian home. Mm. There was no homeschooling. There was no brothers and sisters and family that all got together and we talked about the Lord.
Right.
So that held me back.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine. So religion for religion's sake, rather than.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, okay. Well, considering your at least religious upbringing, did you see science and faith as being connected, or are those separate? Because at this point, obviously, you've come to you've come to faith in Christ, right? And so, are those connected, or in your mind at this point, are they connected?
At this point, they still hadn't connected.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm now a Christian. I'm thinking about the future. I'm still finishing up with construction, realizing I'm not going anywhere. I'm right. using my mind, but my body's not going to be able to do this.
Right.
I mean, I have to be the one with the clipboard, and I'm the boss because I'm not the big iron worker, right?
Right.
But I was in charge of assembling all that stuff and making sure everything got done. And then I had an opportunity. I moved up to the mountains of northeastern California, up in the Sierras. And one of my brothers, who was instrumental in my life, Dr. Thomas Boyle, he said, you know, there's a brand new campus up here, just got set up, Sierra College. You got to go up there and talk to a counselor and see about maybe taking a few classes. I'm going, what? You know, let me think about it. And I worked for a few months, and then I finally went up there and I sat with a counselor, and stuff started clicking.
Right.
I'm going, I could actually do this. And I was an older student, so they're really interested in older students because I have all this worldly experience. And so it was pretty straightforward. I said, well, let's plot a course. I want to go to Humboldt State, where I was supposed to go, you know, 12 years ago. And I want to get into marine sciences because I think the ocean is like the biggest place on earth where you can see all this stuff. And we did that, and I started taking classes. And within the first week, I knew it. I said, I remember this. I used to like it. In fact, I was really good at it once upon a time. I was one of the top kids in my high school, but never had that opportunity or incentive coming from my parents. So
right.
It was misdirection. So anyway, we plotted a course. I went to Sierra College for 3 years, got the general studies out of the way, and then went up to Humboldt State. And I earned a Bachelor of Science in Biology, graduated summa cum laude. Led my whole class out to graduation. Also had a minor in oceanography and almost biometrics. And then I was talking to a lot of the professors up there, and they're about my age at this time. So I'm getting really good advice. I'm going, do I have to get a master's degree? What can I get with a PhD? What should I do now? And they said, you should start writing some letters, and here's some of the places you should write to. So I wrote to 6 different places, and 3 of the doors opened up, and one of them was the University of Hawaii. And I took advantage of that, went out to Hawaii, and got into a field called evolutionary developmental biology, or EVO-DEVO. I didn't even know what it was. But it was definitely planned by the Lord that I was going to take this path. So now I've got a bachelor's in science, did really well, kind of shook it up a little bit, trying to get students to think about God more, and do you believe what you're reading in the textbooks? Because now I'm seeing the controversy.
Mm-hmm.
Once I enter science, I knew what was going on. In fact, before I even got in there, my prayer was this: Lord, take me backstage. Show me how they think. Show me why they think this way. Their interactions, how it all works, the technology they use. Mm. Give me an opportunity to see it from the inside and do some reconnaissance. And I want to go backstage and find out why they're all stuck on this evolutionary theory, which is completely contrary to what you're telling me.
A look behind the curtain.
Absolutely.
Well, that was going to be my next question is you know, you've become a believer at this point, and now you're getting involved in the sciences at an academic level, right? And so, of course, you're going to be taught things. And were you wrestling with any of those deeper questions of like, oh, this is where they say I came from, but this is where scripture says I came from? Was any of that like instrumental? Was there an internal struggle?
You know, there wasn't. It took me a while to really grasp what the evolutionary theory was. Mm. And when it happened in graduate school, because here I'm surrounded by people from all over the world in some of the top laboratories. The waves of Hawaii are crashing at the base of our marine station, and I'm up on the third floor looking at, you know, just paradise. Mm. And I start to work like I do now. I was putting in 6 to 7 days a week there for 6 years. And I started to poke and prod these guys and see what they were, why they think the way they do, without letting them know who I am.
Right.
And I say, why do you agree with this principle right here? Why is this tree giving you the information it is? And that led me to a kind of position where I'm going to bear down even more, but I have to excel. I can't give them any chance to look at me and say, well, you're an average student, in case they find out I'm a Christian, right?
Right.
And I couldn't let them know what was going on, because at that point, they will let you go. They will just come to you one day and say, Michael, you've been doing a great job, but we no longer have funding. We wish you the best. So you can't let them know what's going on.
Right.
But you have an advantage, kind of like David did in the cave with Saul, right? Mm-hmm. He's got an inside information, and he's right there watching the whole thing. And so I took advantage of that, and I excelled. I won every award that was possible, got huge scholarships. Got on the stages, went to all the conferences, made a great number of friends who was amazing, because we didn't really know what I knew what they were thinking, but they had no idea what I was thinking.
Right.
But everything I was doing was in line with what they thought. So I answered the test questions correctly. We looked down the same microscope. I gave them the right answers. I gave them an answer. I gave the fool an answer according to his folly at the right time. And that opened up postdoctoral fellows. So my first postdoctoral fellow application was written to the Smithsonian Institution. And I got the top fellowship that year, went over to Florida to the Smithsonian Marine Station at Fort Pierce, Florida. And I had a 3-year postdoctoral fellowship there.
Wow.
And we have just salt water coming out of the taps in our laboratory. The ocean's right down the street. The weather is fantastic. Very different than Texas.
Yes, I'm sure. It's very hot right now.
Right. And then I get to the end of that and I go, what are you going to do now? So I wrote for another fellowship, and I got another top fellowship, the Tupper Fellowship, and I went down to the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama. Mm. So now I've got two postdoctoral fellows under my belt. And I'm thinking, well, what are my brothers and sisters doing at this point? Where am I leading? Because I'm not going into academia. I'm not going to be a professor in some university and try to teach other kids about something I don't believe in.
Right.
So I got on a plane and I went to a CRS conference. It happened to be right here in Texas down the street.
CRS is the Creation Research Society.
Creation Research Society. And I tried to talk to many of these scientists, and no one would really give me 5 minutes, until one man who gave a great presentation. I asked him if he had time for me, and that was Dr. Galuza. And we sat down at the end of that conference out in the back after the last performance, and we talked for 3.5 hours until we realized how much time had gone by. We never even looked at our watches. So that was an appointment. And then I went to other conferences for the next couple of years, snuck away, you know, vacation time.
Right.
Finally got a job with the Smithsonian. They brought me back, and I became a staff scientist, a biologist. And I took over the life histories program for one of my mentors, who was the second woman in the history of the Smithsonian to be a curator, and the one who was the founder of the Smithsonian Marine Station in Florida.
Wow.
She came out of retirement. I became her last postdoc She taught me everything she knew, and she handed me the keys to the Life Histories program, and I ran that for 6 years until I came here and joined my colleagues here.
Absolutely. Well, we'll get to your time here in just a minute. I just have some questions. I mean, that's a lot of time to spend, we'll say, behind enemy lines.
Right.
Did experiencing all of that, did it strengthen your confidence in certain ideas? Did it cause questions? I mean, I can just imagine, you know, you are the fellowship that you keep, right? And so if you're just surrounded by that day in and day out, was there ever any temptation to be like, yeah, well, they make a good point or anything like that?
No, this is the amazing thing. And I think I was led by the Lord in all of this. So my attitude was, what are we doing today, Father? What are we going to look under the microscope at today? Right. And so I kept on realizing that the more they spoke, the more they were giving answers that I knew were wrong in their eyes, but they were giving me the information that was purposeful, intentional, and accurate to the truth without them knowing it. Somehow I had this filter. In fact, I was in one of the universities one day, and I looked at the huge library, all the stacks of journals and all the periodicals, and I said, how can creationists even keep up with these people? Within about a half hour, it came to me. He says, we don't have to. They've done all the work. We can interpret all that work. We can look at the work that they've done, the methods and materials, as I do now. I'm using the secular journals and tools of major universities, but with a worldview that's completely different than theirs. Mm-hmm. And they were actually feeding me how these animals develop, how these animals grow, what's the DNA and RNA doing at all scales and all levels of biology. And so I had questions answered, and I came up with more questions because of what they said, but it was never in me to compromise. I never felt like I had to compromise. I just had to keep my head down and keep moving forward and don't give them the opportunity to discriminate. Which is crazy. You know, yeah. People discriminate because of your ethnicity, the color of your skin, your gender, and we deal with that. But what's amazing is they're going after something that's in your mind, mm-hmm. something you believe. They can't even see it. But as soon as you mention that,
everything changes.
Everything changes. Yeah. So I had to be strategic.
Incredible. Really sounds like the Lord protected you mentally, emotionally, physically during that time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Incredible. So that leads you to here. Yeah, you're here at ICR, obviously. You're wearing the shirt. You have the logo on it. So you're here. And you mentioned that, you know, you had run into our president, Dr. Galuza. How did that come about other than just the, you know, the conversations and the conferences and sneaking away? How did that come about to you joining staff here at ICR?
So meeting Dr. Galuza was kind of the catalyst. And then I went to these meetings, and little do my colleagues know that I work with now, I was sitting by them and talking to them and passing fossils to them, and I knew who they were. Mm. In fact, I had looked at ICR 15 years before that. I had someone tell me, you know, someday, it was an old brochure from ICR, so someday you could be working for these guys. They go, well, I don't know, but, you know, because I was already speaking out about evolution to all my friends in church. Mm-hmm. I even gave a presentation in one of the churches one night about the difference between evolution and creation. So I was living like a double life, right?
A secret agent.
That was the thing. I had one foot in one camp and one in the other, which is very rare for most people. So I had an opportunity to talk to these guys and listen to them. And Dr. Galuza had already kind of mentioned my name. And as I went back to different conferences, I realized maybe there's a place for me here. And then I'm back at the Smithsonian in Florida, and I get a call once in a while from Dr. G, or he sends me an email. Then the one time he writes me one, he says, I have just become the president of ICR, and I've mentioned your name to the previous presidents, and they didn't bite on that because we had a lot of people here. But I'm wondering if you would ever consider coming out of that world and joining us. Mm. And this was perhaps the most important email in my life. And that's, I think you've heard him say that. So that's how I ended up here. And within a year, I put off a little bit of work and finished what I was doing. And my mentor, Mary Rice, the woman I talked about, she had passed away just before I left. So she's 94 years old. And this is astonishing. So I think we're going to probably bring this subject up, but she is the one who I broached the possibility of something more than evolution that's behind all this, realizing that I'm probably leaving within a year. And I talked to this woman and I said, Mary, do you think that there's more to this? Do you think there's some kind of power, some kind of God behind all of it? I mean, you've been traveling the world with all these amazing scientists and ships and submarines to the bottom of the ocean, and you see all these organisms and we talk about them. Could there be something else? And she said, and I'm thinking she's going to freak out at this point. And she says, Michael, this is one of the most toughest questions I've ever had in my life. So when I was in college, I had this question posed to me and I couldn't sleep. And she went for a walk for like half a day. And she came back and says, I have made my decision. I have to choose between science and faith, between evolution and non-life, right? Or whatever category it was. And I realized that she had a dichotomy. And now I look back and all those people I was working with, they had a dichotomy. They think you can't have the two joined up like that. And that's, We should probably talk more about that. Yes. That is foundational.
That's a big thing. And at 94 years old and
yeah, she'd seen it all.
She'd seen everything. And I'm sure that was a difficult question to broach for you. I mean, dangerous even, you know, at that
yeah.
point. All right. So you're here at ICR.
Yeah, I have joined the family at ICR.
Welcome. Glad you're here. So what are you working on? What do you do here? What is so exciting about ICR other than just the worldview, obviously, but that led you to come from the Smithsonian of all places? People would kill to work there.
I know.
There.
Why would I leave them?
Right.
It was a valuable experience. Yeah. I met some amazing people, but they have a worldview that's non-compromising.
Right.
And that did not fit and would never fit the way I think. So,
absolutely.
Having access to all the money and the prestige and the you know all the different technology was not enough to sway me. I knew that I had brothers and sisters here, and I knew some of these scientists that thought like me and they had walked like me in secular universities and had their degrees. And so, what's good about that is we have both perspectives.
Right.
They have one perspective. So that's what led me there. So Dr. G, he told me over the phone that during that first call, I'm bringing you on to study engineer biology. We have this new thing going on here, and I got a couple guys that are dabbling in it, but no one's really taking it on. So when you come here, this is what you're going to be doing. And I arrived, and right away I saw the potential here, and then over the next probably year, because at this point, I'm still not public because I'm working on this secret project, which I'll probably bring up. But that kept me out of the spotlight. So I've been here for 4 years at that point, or actually 4.5 years now.
Right.
And
this is your big public debut.
And this
right
is
now.
This is my public debut because we had a lot of work to do.
Right.
Fortunately, I think that was also ordained by the Lord because He had me put together three major laboratories that ICR has never had before, that no other creation group has ever had before. With the top technology that people come in and say, this is what we see at the university is either equal to or better than we have access to. So we're talking about the whole aquaculture system and aquariums for working with animals. And I'm a developmental biologist, which I'm going to get into. Mm-hmm. And then when I put together the imaging center with state-of-the-art microscopy, stereoscopes, compound scopes, and a laser scanning confocal microscope. And I'll share images with that. And then, I put together a molecular biology laboratory. So this is DNA, RNA, proteins, and going from the macroscopic view of a fish to the microscopic view of the anatomy and the internal anatomy and the cellular level of the fish. And now we're going to what you can't see anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the molecules and biomolecules and that run in the cells and are responsible for making the whole organism, every organism, work on Earth, and that's the genetic code and all that goes with it.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned fish.
Yeah.
Right. What kind of fish? Obviously not your Alaskan salmon.
Right. So I spent 20 years working with marine vertebrates, and then I come here and I'm working with fish. But as I mentioned, I'm a developmental biologist. So when you're looking at any organism, you're getting the chance to follow life from the first fertilization from a single cell, which is called the totipotent cell. It's got the complete potential to build an entire organism that's capable of making more of itself. Mm-hmm. But now I'm working with a vertebrate, so the nerve cord is on the dorsal side instead of the ventral side. It's a little more complicated, but the procedure and the strategy for studying these is about the same. So I was taking pictures. I began to fix these fish, that is, raise them, get them drunk with some cocktails in the laboratory, fix them with fixatives so the morphology is perfect, and then start to look at them under the microscope and get an idea of what I'm looking at. That's the first thing you do in development and actually in biology is, what is the organism? What does it look like? What are the left, right, dorsal, ventral, anterior, posterior sides? Where are the organ systems? How are they different from other fish and right. so on, and make that comparative view. So I dove in all the way with these K-fish. And the K-fish system, as shown here, in fact, these are the two fish we're working with. You have one fish on the top that has a definite set of pigment or a pigmentation pattern and a functional eye. Mm-hmm. Okay,
looks just like a normal fish.
Looks like a normal fish. And the one on the bottom is orange, so it has very little pigment, and it has no eye. But it builds an eye in the first 24 hours. And this is the marvelous thing. So here comes engineered biology. Why does it lose an eye? Why does one have one and one doesn't? Is that purposeful? Is that intentional? Is this evolution? What's going on?
Right.
And I started to dive into that. And so what I've been doing for the last 3 years is characterizing in depth all of the different anatomy of the animal, especially the adaptations that these fish have.
Sure.
This is actually one of the icons of evolution today. Mm. It has so many variations compared to the surface fish that what you see is different organs and organ systems that are optimized and they're compensating for the loss of vision. Not unlike human beings. So right. people who are born blind or become blind through disease, they can sense vibration better, they can hear better, they can taste and smell more acutely than we do. Same thing's going on in these fish. So now I've understood the biology of them and the anatomy of them. And now we're going to take that to a whole nother level going forward.
Absolutely. Well, I have a question for you real quick. We are going to dive deep into this, and I'm so excited for it. But you're a scientist, right? And you hold a biblical worldview, and you spend all this time in secular academia and in the secular world. So what do your peers think of you? That's the question that I have for you. I mean, surely now they'll see you and they'll be like, wow, he did all of this and now he's here. What happened? I mean, where is this misunderstanding? What is so different about scientists with a biblical worldview?
This is an enormous question.
Yes.
Okay. So as far as my peers and my colleagues go, they're still wondering where I am. Mm-hmm. I think a couple of them have an idea. In fact, I wrote about a month ago to one of my colleagues, and he told me about the book and the big atlas that I put together.
For the Smithsonian?
For the Smithsonian, or while I was at the Smithsonian, right. and then I carried that work over here. And he says, we're all, you know, kind of wondering what happened to Michael Boyle. Where is he? It's the new game we play. Because I was so much present in their lives, I was hosting a laboratory and bringing them in the summers, and we would go out on ships of opportunity out to the Gulf Coast and out to the Gulf Stream and collect all these plankton and all these animals and study them. The thing is, they are probably thinking, this guy was on a roll. He's got over 40 publications. He's got chapters and books. He just put out a massive textbook. And then what happened to him? Something's wrong, right? What happened to Michael? Mm-hmm. And what gets me is that I tried to tell them in different ways without actually telling them the gospel, that you're not thinking correctly about this theory. There's more to it. What about this? What about that? Well, we can't explain that yet. We haven't got to those things yet, but we've known them for a long time. So I'm trying to help them along, and they're not really grabbing that. And I realize even more so now. It's time to move on. But as we grow away from each other, they're not reaching back out and trying to find out what's going on. They're probably still wondering what happened to him because he left the Smithsonian. Like you said, who would leave the Smithsonian?
Right.
The problem is I've seen both sides. They have never seen the other side. I think once you see that side, you're either going to be afraid of it or not understand it and think, well, their faith is blinding them. They can't see the truth because they're in this religious atmosphere, or this religious perspective.
Right.
The truth is, once you put both of them together, you get an even deeper truth. You get a more comprehensive view.
That
the Bible is telling you exactly who made it, when he made it, and how he made it. And everything you see is lining up with the science that I learned in academia from secular institutions. And they're not able to see that. That's that reprobate mind that we see in Romans 1. Their mind is given over, so they're blind to that. That's why God says we're without excuse, right? I don't know where that's going to go. I have a feeling they're going to continue to wonder for a while, and then we're going to have some conversations.
Do you think that they've even tried to consider that worldview, the quote-unquote religious worldview?
Well, I'm optimistic, you know, but there's something about this. So once you start down the academic road, you go from high school into college, and you're wondering where that goes. And then you go to graduate school. That's a big step. And the next step is now you've invested a bunch of money and time. You're going to go be a professor somewhere. And you get your assistantship and then associate professor and then full professor. By the time you get along that line, you've got 30 years invested. You've got graduate students coming in, postdoctoral fellows. You're writing grants from National Science Foundation, and your reputation is in the journals. You're not going to throw that away. You're going to defend that.
Right.
And that's the blindness. So once it's kind of self, affirming.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get that far along, the chances of you looking back and saying, do I have this right? You would need a radical change in your life. Death of a family member, an accident, something to wake you up. Or maybe someone off the street that you can't judge because you don't know their background and who they are. And they come and tell you about Jesus. Have you thought about Jesus? Did you know that you can be saved?
Mm.
Well, what does saved mean, right? But you plant those seeds and you let the Holy Spirit do the work. So that's what we have to do. And that's fortunately what we're doing right here with science, is we're not only equipping our believers and strengthening them, we are putting this out wide enough so those guys are, in their quiet time, they're thinking, what are these guys up to? In fact, they might be looking at this work and going, you know, Michael's way out there now. He's kind of lost it, but we're not doing that.
Right.
He knows what he's doing. He was with us. He knew all the skills. He had skills we wanted to use and learn about. So they're quietly probably wondering, am I on the right track? That's what I hope for them anyway.
I honestly think that hopefully they'll see this or see your work down the road, and maybe it'll open some doors.
Yeah. In fact, let me dive into that work a little bit.
Yeah, I was about to say, we need to talk about the cavefish.
Okay.
Because you got some beautiful pictures up here.
I do. So to begin with, like I said, I study marine invertebrates. And my eye was led toward the life cycles, the complex life cycles. As you go from a fertilized egg, and then you make a larval form that gets up into the current and it travels. And this is how the marine invertebrates travel the world.
Mm-hmm.
They travel on the paths of the seas that Matthew Murray found, right? He was
from reading Psalms.
He's the grandfather of the modern oceanography today. He found that thing, that statement in I think it was Psalms and or Job, the paths of the seas. Mm-hmm. And so he set out to find those paths and characterize them as a naval officer. Well, in those paths are organisms like this. So this is a broad diversity of larval forms. This is a brachiopod. This is a baby starfish. Okay? This is a three, it's got three bands on it, and this makes a sea butterfly. and you've got a tunicate over here, and it looks like the head of Darth Vader. You got a flatworm with all ciliated, a polychaete, a cnidarian, and then one of my favorites is this little subhunculin worm here. This is just a smattering of the diversity here. But all of these are the teenage years or the juvenile years of when you're sending your children off to school. Mm. They're going to go across the earth. They're going to go to deeper waters. They're going to go up along the coast. They're going to get into the currents. They're going to find new opportunities for reproduction, new food sources. They're going to continue their kin, like moving or emigrating from Ireland to the United States. Right. And you're going to keep your families going. That's what these guys do.
Okay.
And they're absolutely fascinating. And this is the centerpiece of the atlas that I put together that contains over 40 authors.
I am surprised that there's so many different types.
Yeah, in 800 pages. But I'm not satisfied. I want to go look deeper.
Yes.
So now we're looking at the musculature that forms the bands of muscles that are around the body that allow these guys to crawl and move and so on. And then each one of these little white dots is DNA in the nucleus of a single cell. And it outlines perfectly the digestive system, and it shows you where the nerve cord is. The smaller you go in scale, the more information you get and the better understanding you get of anything on the, especially in the biology. But
this
applies to all disciplines. Mm. And then my favorite is studying the development. So here's two different types of microscopes. These organisms are a single worm going through development. This is the marine worm going from 12 hours to 1, 2, 3, and 4 days on the top. And they're kind of see-through. And this is what a compound light microscope shows you. So you can look into the animal. You can see where the organ systems and the body plan is. And then you can stain them with fluorophores and antibodies. And using the confocal microscope, I can excite those molecules. And they jump up in energy and they give off a wavelength of light that gets captured. And I go slice by slice like an MRI. Mm. And I take three-dimensional images through the body. So now I'm going, instead of the tissues on the outside, I'm now looking at the cellular structure, the nervous system in green, the muscle fibers in red, DNA in gray, and this beautiful yellow ring, which is all the cilia that allows it to swim through the water.
So you can specifically target which system you're looking for.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so this is all feeding into the K-fish.
Right.
I'm taking the same skills, the same technology, and now we're looking at embryonic fish, embryonic larvae.
And you learned this through your secular academia
and
skills in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, there's 25 years of research into these techniques. And it's some of the best stuff. I'm not going to be a braggart here, but some of these images have won a lot of national awards. And it's not because I'm a great technician. It's because I'm so excited about what I'm looking at. I aim for the art first.
Right.
And if you do that correctly and you get the animals in perfect form and all the colors are there, the biology will speak to you. The biology is going to come back. And then here's an extension of that. This is a whole set of different embryos in fish, in amphibians, in reptiles, in birds, even our species. And it shows you that there's a diversity in the type of embryo that gives rise to different animals. There's no way these could all come from a single egg back in the history of time.
Right.
They're so unique that every cell division is on its trajectory to build that animal and no other animal.
Yeah, most of them, at least by step two, there's a lot of difference, and some of them are different all the way on step one.
Yeah, and if you go off the page here, if it was to extend, you'll see that they go farther and farther away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And yet one of this kind of theme was used by Ernst Haeckel to try to tell us about the evolution of animals.
Yes.
And they all came from one animal and they all share this path that they go through. It's called ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which is false. But this is, everything I see is in defiance of the evolutionary paradigm.
It's complex.
It's more and more complex information that points to the unlimited power and wisdom of our Creator.
Incredible. Okay, so this is obviously, you've got all these skills, you've got this interest, you know what you're doing. And so that leads us to the K-Fish. You already mentioned, you know, you spent several years documenting and going up and down the every length of the fish to determine what's there and what's working. So why? What's the purpose? What are you doing?
Well, okay, so in our mission statement here, as you've probably heard many times, we're trying to change Chris's view of biology by constructing an organism-focused theory of biological design that highlights Jesus' work as creator. Therefore, we oppose the deification of nature. Nature cannot select, it can't discriminate, it can't choose between one object or the other. It has no mind, it has its own thought process.
Can't be creative.
It is an idol, it is a false god. And that's the god of evolution. Nature, natural selection. So we're putting together engineering biology. And so I'm looking at these fish now with a combination of my understanding of biology and cellular biology and molecular biology. And Dr. Galuz's look at engineering, where you have sensors and logic and processors and responders that are in these organisms. So for the last couple of years, I've been looking deeply through the microscopy at all the different adaptations that are compensating for the loss of vision. Better feeding apparatus, more teeth, bigger jaws, more hemoglobin in every blood cell to get little oxygen that's in the cave. In fact, the cave is completely dark, has very little food and very little oxygen. So they go in there, they lose their eye, and they have to navigate their underground habitat right now. And so the nervous system is allowing them to sense all the movement of the water, not to bump into the caves, to find their partner and do a mating with two blind fish, which I would say is a blind date, right? And the same thing with metabolism. I mean, they've got high fatty acids, high triglycerides, they're insulin resistant, they're hyperglycemic, all the things that are bad for us, they're thriving on. And we've come to learn through the secular work that the eyes are actually being shut down purposefully by engineering at a certain time during development so that nothing is broken, nothing is missing. In fact, all the eyes that are responsible for building, all the genes that are responsible for building an eye, they're not lost, they're not mutated, they're not broken. They're in the fish, they're under regulation. So as I began to study all these adaptations, three or four images, extensive images in every fish in every stage, left side, right side, dorsal, ventral, you start to piece this together and then you compare it with the surface fish. And now we're looking at the eye from some very, very highly magnified images. We have an eye showing the retina and the lens and the optic nerve. And then we show the little white vesicles that are coming out of that, that show DNA that's falling out of an eye that's programmed to go through a process called cell death or apoptosis. And then recently I used an antibody to show all the cells that are undergoing division. That means they're living cells. Mm. So we can show the lens is dying, and we can show that there's no living cells in the lens. And that's the process by which the eye is being removed. In the meantime, all the other, you know, the systems that run hearing and sound and feeding and sensation and metabolism are now optimized and compensating for this fish. This is not an accident. This is purposeful, intentional engineering for a fish that's going into environment, a new environment, as of the flood, approximately 4,370 plus or minus 5 years ago, depending on who calculates, right? So they're in new caves, and all the animals that are in there are in new caves, and they're doing exactly what they're supposed to do. Humans disobey the mandate, but the animals are still going after the mandate to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. So not only are the fish are in these caves, but there's salamanders, and there's shrimp, and there's centipedes and millipedes, and other animals in the water and animals on the walls, and they're all blind, and they all have little pigments. So now we have a phenomenon that's not just in one cave, it's worldwide. So I've begun to move from that. And we just launched into a brand new project where we're going to the scale that's way down below what we can see. Mm-hmm. It's inferred, and you can look in the molecular laboratory, because I did 20 years of this, looking at gene expression and working with little tubes of invisible solutions And knowing what it's supposed to find and then doing the experiments, sending them off to a lab somewhere in the US or Korea, having it come back and verify that that's exactly what we see. That gene matches all the other genes and so on. So now we've, with my assistant, Michael Lane, who's my right hand, he's really good at raising the fish, we've extracted all of the embryos and different larval stages for 3 days. We sent them to a major sequencing facility up in Maryland, and they received those about a week and a half ago, and they're going to sequence the transcriptomes, which is all the genes that are expressed during the first day, the second day, and the third day, and then they're going to sequence the entire genome, 50 chromosomes that are in each cell of the fish, and then the regulated genome that has markers on it. And now we're going to get to the nitty-gritty. Now we're going to look at the small things that are behind the complex operation of the whole animal, which happens in bacteria all the way up to the animals and then to man, who stands separate.
It's funny you say the small things, when all of this is very small, generally speaking.
From the invisible to all the way up. Yeah. And so this is really critical.
Yeah, absolutely.
And once we get into it, this is going to take us for the next 2 years. Dr. Tompkins will join, and we're going to be looking at the genome together. And I'm going to be able to pick out certain genes and make copies of them and show when and where they're being expressed during development and try to get at the molecular mechanisms for patterning the eye, building an eye, or turning the eye off purposely.
Why is this happening, and when is it happening?
And when is it happening?
Incredible.
So it's the small things that are really key to everything else.
Well, you had mentioned this is all very exciting. And so I've had this thing in the back of my mind, like, this sounds so incredible. Why is this particular fish, this one that we're working with, why has it historically been considered an icon of evolution? Like, what sets it apart?
Yeah, so to get to the icons of evolution, this was kind of a spin that was put off by someone who was kind of mocking the icons of evolution. Mm. So some of the icons are the Galapagos finches, fruit fly, peppered moth, Darwin's tree of life. In fact, here's an example. Here's Darwin's tree of life. Mm. This is more sophisticated, but it shows all the relationships of every animal, every multicellular animal. So the metazoa. By the way, everyone on the tip of these branches are called phyla. They're body plan level animals. Only one at the very bottom is the only one that does not have some kind of representative in the ocean. So this is why I've been spending so much time in the ocean.
Right.
I've been living by the ocean and working in the ocean for the past 25 years.
It must have been a terrible sacrifice.
It was a major sacrifice. I try to get back there anytime I can.
Right.
But this is what the tree looks like with all these branchings. And these branchings are supposedly the unlimited number of evolutionary experiments where you bifurcate from non-life to the first cell, and the first cell has a genome that's going to give rise to everything, including you and me.
Mm-hmm.
It's so fantastic. It's so wild. But this is one of the major icons of evolution, all driven by natural selection. Now, if I take this paper up here and put it right along the side, you see a bunch of straight lines.
Yeah.
That's creation.
Yeah.
They were all made together in a series of plants on day 3 and then all the animals in day 5 and 6. Even the sun coming up on day 4 in anticipation that the plants are going to need that sun the next day. So there's the genesis itself, you could spend months in there.
Yeah.
And especially looking at the commentary by Henry Morris. It's fantastic.
Absolutely. We have that here.
Yeah.
Take a look.
So these fish, they are now considered the fastest evolving model. And that means somewhere between 8 million and 200,000 years ago, these fish swam into the caves. The surface fish, this one on top, mm-hmm. swam into the cave and became the cavefish. Radically different. Now, they're the same species. They can mate and they can have babies with eyes. Not all of them, but a portion of them. All of this is regulated at the molecular level.
Right.
So this is one of these.
So hold on. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't want to skate past that. The fact that they can mate and have babies with eyes proves that they are, in fact, not really, that's not evolution from
either. Correct. What,
okay.
Correct.
Yes.
They have the capacity. The biochemistry works. The cells work. Everything's there. They're turned off.
Right.
God turned those off. In fact, to keep your eye going, that's expensive.
From like a power.
Some say it's 15% of your metabolism, your energy budget, just to keep the eye going. And then another 5% or so to keep the pigment going. But you don't need your eye in the dark of a cave. It was just completely black. They're miles back. And you don't need pigment to protect you because the sun's not hitting your eyes.
Right.
But these are icons. And because they're icons, they're considered kind of by definition, they are the greatest representatives of natural selection in action.
Okay.
Now the scientists have turned to this one because it supposedly happened relatively fast, and they can seemingly track these changes, and there's so many different changes in one fish versus the other that this has become an icon and this has become an example. Same with the Darwin's finches.
Right.
The Darwin's finches have always been finches.
Right.
They change season by season. You need a caliper to look at the differences in their beaks. But as the seeds change, their beaks change. And the seeds change back, their beaks change back. They haven't always been and will always be finches.
And they're never anything else.
And if you throw the time thing out, you knock that pillar of time down, none of this is possible.
Right.
So that's key to all of it.
Incredible. All right, so how does all of this point together? Like, okay, so we have this idea of like, this is an icon of evolution. We're showing engineered biology, but where is all of this headed from a scientific point of view? I mean, the fish are cool, finding the specific switches and the genetic markers, incredible stuff. But what's the bigger picture for moving things forward scientifically?
Okay, so let me put it in the context of our model.
Okay.
So continuous environmental tracking, in a very simple way, a simple way to say it, is that we believe that the Lord made every single organism with the ability to sense the conditions in their environment. They do it continuously and actively. And then they self-adjust internally at every level. Biochemistry, DNA, every cell, every tissue, every organ system. The bottom line here is that the organism is the one doing the change. Mm-hmm. Nature has no power, no creative ability. So we oppose the deification of nature, right? This is one of our mission statements.
Yes.
So we raise up Jesus' name, Jesus' power, his forethought and wisdom. So what this model is showing us is that God programmed in every single organism the ability to thrive on a world that is changing. A world he knew was going to go through the fall, and a world that he knew was going to go through a major flood, a major judgment upon mankind, and that they'd have to survive that, and the environment would be changed in many different places.
Yes.
So what these fish are doing, they're just an example. We could do this with any organism on the planet. And by looking at all the other animals in the cave, we're seeing that it's not limited to fish.
Mm-hmm.
A whole diversity of body plans and organisms are doing this. So the message here is that we have a divine engineer who has programmed extensive abilities we haven't even really realized yet in all organisms to be functional, to serve each other, to serve the planet, to serve us, right? Every single organism is interdependent at some level with every other organism. The bacteria, they fix nitrogen out of the air, which we can't do. No other organisms can do it.
Mm.
They turn it into a form that's usable. They feed it into the fungus underneath the ground, which passes it to the roots of the tree, which sends it up the tree to build metabolites and give out oxygen, which we need to breathe. And we exhale,
but
thank you,
yeah.
Right? And that CO2 goes back to feed the tree.
Yeah.
So that's just a very simple example of how all these different organisms are in a chain of interaction and interdependency. It's elegant.
Yeah, incredible. It takes a lot of planning for something like someone way smarter than us.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so for the average person, someone who's not a scientist, someone who has maybe just only a passing interest in science, they're like, okay, yes, Jesus created, right? Or maybe they're like, okay, it's cool that all of this pieces together. But why should someone care about this? Why put concerted thought and effort into understanding this?
Okay, well, so first of all, as I think I mentioned earlier, that we are without excuse if we don't recognize that an all-wise being of some kind, which we know is God, which we know is Jesus in the Holy Spirit, right? They're the triune God, are responsible for all of this. Their lives depend upon that. They were created. The babies that we have in generation after generation were created. And if they really look hard enough, they're going to realize that everyone dies. We have graveyards. We have grandpa and great-grandpa, and before them, they're all gone. So we have a mortality we're dealing with. So there has to be something more to this life. There has to be a purpose to it. We're not just wandering through time. And if they talk to the right person, and especially if they get their eyes upon the scripture or hear it, they're going to realize this is much bigger than they thought. And if they miss it, this could be the biggest mistake they make in their life. Everything comes down to that one decision. You either accept the offer from God or you don't. What most people don't realize is that we're all getting out alive. Most people in the world, the secular world, they think everyone's going to die. No one gets out alive. No, you're all getting out alive, but you're going to one of two places, eternal death or eternal life. You're going to live forever in one of those, and you're going to have a body that's going to withstand one and be in pleasure with the other. So every breath you take, every one of your relationships, your family, the extended family, the family you didn't realize you had that's not your biological family, is put here by the same one who created all the stuff I've been talking about. Mm. The eggs, the larvae in the ocean, which is the largest habitable space on Earth. 92% of all the diversity on Earth is in the ocean. All of that is feeding us. It's giving us oxygen. It's taking care of everything we do. It's all interconnected. And if you don't get that, you're not gonna realize why we're here.
Yeah.
So as soon as you start to look at that stuff, and you can't hide from it because it's everywhere, look in the mirror. Look no further than yourself. You're breathing. Your heart's beating. You're filtering. You have no control over that. You came into a world where the gas mixture was perfectly balanced. It was at just the right pressure. You took a breath from the very first time you came out, and you've been breathing ever since, and you probably never thought about it. And if you're without that breath for 5 minutes, you're done. That's how fragile we are. That's how fragile we are. So let me leave you with one message that's connected to all this. You're without breath for 5 minutes to 6 minutes. There are 240 intervals of 6 minutes in a day. There's 37,600 intervals of 6 minutes in a year. You can share the gospel with someone in 6 minutes, and that will save their life.
Amen.
That's the power of all of this.
What about those? You mentioned your mentor.
And
she said that she made her choice, and she chose science. What would you say to someone who says, I have to choose? I either choose science or I choose quote-unquote religion.
Yeah, it's a false choice. You're posed with that decision by those who don't believe in God, the God of the Bible.
Right.
Okay? They make you think that you have a choice. You either give this up and go that way, or you stay where you are and let that go where it is. But science actually affirms the creation. It supports the creation. You're looking at the works, the acts, and the evidence of God, right? He's pointing that out to us.
Clearly seen.
So that's a false choice. In fact, this same woman, I went all the way to a day before her deathbed and asked her once again, and she took my hand and said, Michael, I've made my decision. It's one of the saddest things I've ever seen, especially after seeing all that. So this is life or death. Yeah. And we're talking about, again, eternal life or eternal death. It is the most important decision in anyone's life.
Yeah.
And I feel for the people who are not catching that, but to think that you have to make a choice is wrong between science and faith. They're intertwined. Once you realize that and you combine the two, your faith is strengthened. Your faith starts to grow. You realize that everything he said he did, he actually did. And more. And now you're looking for it more. And if you become a Christian, now you've got the witness of the Holy Spirit within you, who's continuously reaffirming, let me show you this, let me show you that. And you get that answer. You know that you know. Whether you hear a voice or not, every time I do these experiments, it's like, oh, I could not have seen that. Right. I looked at it for years. There's no way I could see this. And this is happening all the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you would say that this study of studying creation in general and doing science in this way has deepened your faith?
Absolutely. It's deepened my faith in many different ways. It's not an academic study. It's not a superficial reading or putting the words together. It's actually life. It's within us and outside of us. Everything on this planet is created for him, created by him, created through him. He sustains it all. He's coming back to retrieve it. We know from the flood that he judged it once, and we can believe he's going to judge it again exactly how he does. So my faith is strengthened by looking at science and looking at biology. And my understanding of biology is enhanced by the faith that I have in God. He told us when he did it. He told us that he did it. He wrote it down for us.
Yeah.
What more do you need?
Couldn't get any clearer, right? Well, thank you so much, Dr. Boyle, for everything that you shared with us. Your story's incredible, and it's been a pleasure chatting with you today.
Thank you.
Science is ultimately about asking questions, exploring truth, and understanding the world around us. From Dr. Boyle's personal journey to his current research on blind cavefish, we've seen how curiosity, discovery, and faith can intersect in powerful ways. And whether you're passionate about science, faith, or simply asking deeper questions about life, we hope this episode encouraged you to keep exploring. Dr. Boyle, before we wrap up, what do you personally hope that viewers will take away from this?
I think what's most important is what you just kind of hit on, that you don't have to make a choice between one avenue of pursuit by humanity and another, what this person says or that person says. All of it is valuable, all of it's important. But there's one most important question. Do you believe? Will you come to believe in the one who is calling your name? Because he's told us about that. I'm hoping that through biology, through science, through engineering, through medicine, through all of the activities, in fact, every vocation that man does that's worthy, even the EMT on the sidewalk and the teacher, all of it is an expression of him. Mm. And we should be able to see that in everything that humanity does. If you're looking even a little bit, you put a little bit of effort, you will see God in everything.
Well, thank you again so much for just gracing us with all of your knowledge and expertise. You can partner with our ministry by joining our members and patrons community by clicking the link in the description. Their names are scrolling on screen right now. And one of our viewers actually has a question for you, Dr. Boyle. Are you ready for this?
I am.
John Sims asks, where are the cracks in the undirected mutation paradigm emerging in academia?
That's a good question, John. That's a huge question, actually. We've been told for many years that mutation and natural selection are a combination that has been driving the origin and evolution of life on Earth. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're finding now, with all our sophistication, sequencing efforts, and going deeper into the RNA and DNA world, we didn't even know 20 years ago, that many of these mutations are actually purposeful. They're not mutations at all. They're likely to be little switches and levers that have been turned on and turned off. The movement of DNA from one location in the genome to another, the removal of sections that only come back later on, the regulation that's where these fish's eyes are turned off that I've been talking about, these are not mutations that cause the loss of the eye. It's a regulatory apparatus, as you know. When you cross these two fish, you can make that eye come back. That means it's completely functional. So I think the mutation idea is on its way out, but that's got to be understood with caution, because we are still under the fall. We are still undergoing decay. We have developmental abnormalities. We have cancer. We have disabilities in elderly people and even children, which is sad. But that doesn't mean that's mutation. That means that God is bringing us home, and He's letting it all wind down, especially in a very different time frame than He did before the flood, mm-hmm. where people lived for a long time. I think He wants us home sooner. But I would be looking, John, to more and more mutations if you can. Look at the literature, and you'll find out that some of those mutations really aren't mutations. We don't really use the word mutation anymore. We think they're purposeful, or if not, they're part of the decay that's going on and things just happen. In a simple way to say it, when you take 10 different sequences of the same gene from 10 of the same species of an animal, sometimes you'll see a C and a C and a C and then a T and a T as you go down the list, that these letters in the alphabet of the DNA molecule are changing within the same species. We used to call that mutation.
Not anymore.
Those are living, functional, reproducing animals. So the mutation paradigm has to be changed. And we realize now, in fact, that what we thought was 3% of the genome is functional, we now are up past 80%, where most of the genome is functional in at least one cell type in man and mice. So,
and we're heading the rest of the way.
I don't think there's anything called junk DNA, right? I'm not following the mutation the way I used to.
Well, thank you for answering.
Yes.
And thank you for joining us for the Season 5 premiere of the Creation Podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe, leave a comment, and share this conversation with someone who's curious about the evidence for creation. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.